This is an RCGP podcast on the subject of how we can distinguish between COVID-19 and flu. I'm Dr. Barbara Noble, a GP from Wolverhampton, and I'm here with Dr. Tom Neal, who is a GP and faculty educator from North Wales, and Dr. Jessica Watson, a GP from Bristol and an NIHR research fellow at the University of Bristol. We're now at the end of August, and we seem to have emerged from the first wave of COVID-19, though infection rates both in the UK and Europe seem to be increasing. But most people are of the opinion that there will be a second wave in the autumn and winter, which will then overlap with the flu season. So how are we going to distinguish between the two? The original paper from Wuhan in BMJ back in March highlighted cough, fever, and fatigue as the three main symptoms of COVID-19, which of course are very similar to flu. Has that been your experience, Tom, about the symptoms of COVID-19?
Hi, yes, Barbara. I think originally during the pandemic, we were all very focused, as you mentioned, on cough and fever. But as time's gone by, we've started to recognise that there are lots of other symptoms of COVID that causes quite a broad spectrum of disease. So in my clinical practice, yes, I've predominantly seen people presenting with a cough, but also there's been a wide variety of other symptoms. And I think as time's gone by, we as GPs have started to pick up and notice that. So looking at the symptoms, I've certainly in my practice have seen rashes and experienced the acral rashes on the toes, which are chilblain-like. Also, I've had a lot of patients presenting with GI symptoms, such as diarrhea, nausea and vomiting, and a few ocular manifestations with conjunctivitis. I think the really important one which has come up has been an osmia. And certainly in my practice, that's quite a predominant symptom. To the extent that now we're screening people and asking them whether they've experienced an osmia recently as a symptom of COVID and something we're looking out for. And I think that is much more in the public awareness. So as time's gone by, what I've seen in my practice is that it's evolved and that we're recognising all the different manifestations of it, which certainly makes life as a GP a bit more interesting, but probably a little bit more complex as well. And I think we need to recognise that we're dealing perhaps with an evolving illness, which we're developing more of an awareness of the different manifestations of it. So in a sense, I feel a little bit like I'm in an uncharted territory.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah. And Jessica, the Oxford Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine has done some work on tracking symptoms. What are they saying?
Thanks. Yes. Well, the evidence is matching with Tom's clinical experience that he's described there, that actually, yes, those three cardinal symptoms that we're all hearing about, the cough, fever and anosmia, are very important, but there are a wide variety of other symptoms that patients can present with, including skin rashes, gastrointestinal symptoms, also ocular symptoms, so conjunctivitis. It's a real challenge for us in primary care because all of these are common presentations that we will see. This is all kind of our bread and butter. And so I think particularly as winter starts to approach, we're going to have to really start to think, could this be COVID? When we're looking at patients with flu-like symptoms, but also being really alert when we're diagnosing tonsillitis, when we diagnose gastroenteritis, asthma exacerbations, headaches, tiredness. Well, could this be COVID?
Tom, have you seen any unusual cases of COVID, any unusual presentations in your practice?
One case which comes to mind is a gentleman who presented having been in a household where both children and the wife had been tested positive for COVID. He'd developed the classical symptoms which we're just talking about, of a cough with a fever and generally feeling myalgic. And then quite quickly afterwards, he noticed that he developed a tinnitus symptoms, which had been fairly persistent over 2 months since his initial infection. That wasn't something that I was particularly aware of, but certainly it seemed to be directly attributed to his initial illness. I thought the case was also quite interesting because it touched a little bit upon testing, in that he definitely had COVID symptoms. Three members of his family had been tested positive, but he'd been tested negative. But I think fortunately he had the wherewithal to recognise that the test which he'd had, the swab test, probably wasn't 100%. So he'd counted himself as had it, and then he'd had these ongoing tinnitus symptoms. They were slightly unilateral, so I actually ended up referring him on. And I think that maybe is another important point, is that we can get a little bit caught up in the mixture of this variety of symptoms caused by COVID. But I think we still have to use our diagnostic knowledge and a little bit of our experience to recognise that people can still have red flag symptoms, and perhaps we shouldn't just attribute everything to COVID, and we should be still managing them as we would do normally as GPs if we're worried or concerned.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Tom. Yes. So in summary, COVID can present with very mild symptoms, just like an sort of URTI, or more severe symptoms resembling flu, but you've got up to 50% of patients having anosmia, and then many can have sort of atypical symptoms like rashes and ocular symptoms. Tom mentioned testing, and that's going to be paramount, isn't it, in distinguishing between COVID-19 and flu. But how accurate is the test, Jessica?
Well, we've got to remember no test is 100% accurate. So the main test that we're using at the moment to try and diagnose COVID is swab tests, which detect particles of virus in the throat or the nose. And it's difficult to put exact figures on the accuracy of these tests. But overall, we know that these swabs are highly specific, but have got modest sensitivity. So what that means is a positive test is good to help you rule in coronavirus, but a negative test is not as reliable to rule out. So to try and explain why that is, I mean, another way of explaining sensitivity is to think of it as the true positive rate. So it's really useful for an epidemiologist. So if you want to know if you've got 100 patients with coronavirus, how many of those will be picked up by a positive test? And if we have a sensitivity of 70%, 70 out of 100 patients who've got COVID will be correctly picked up by the test. This is really important to know because, of course, those false negatives are a particular concern, as these people might go about assuming they haven't got the infection and can potentially spread the disease. But the problem for us as GPs is we want to know something slightly different. We want to know, for my patient in front of me who's got a positive or a negative test result, what's the chance that they've got COVID? Now, that is something different. That's our positive or negative predictive value there. And the challenge here is that the positive predictive value depends not just on how accurate the test is, but it depends on who we choose to have do the test upon.
If I get this right, so if a person tests positive, they've got COVID-19, but if they test negative, they could still have it, basically.
Well, yes, but it's not quite as simple as that, because to interpret the test, we need to know their pre-test probability of infection, as well as the accuracy of the test itself. So this is what's called Bayes' theorem, and it's something we probably all remember from many years ago in medical school, and kind of forget about a little bit. It's a simple way to explain it is it's like the duck test. So the saying goes, if it looks like a duck, if it moves like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, it probably is a duck. The same applies to COVID. So if someone's got typical cough, anosmia, and perhaps a history of exposure, it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck. Even if their test is negative, we have to think it could still be COVID-19. So that's the Bayes theorem. And I think as GPs, we can be a bit scared of this and think, it's maths. This isn't what my area. But actually, what I think we forget is actually this is our bread and butter. We do this all the time. So every time you look at your patient's blood test results and you see an abnormal result, the first thing you will do is you will look at who was the patient and why did they have the test done. And what you're doing there is you're trying to estimate the pre-test probability, and then you're interpreting your test result in the context of that patient. So that is our natural, we don't do it mathematically, we do it intuitively. But the problem is we need to sort of calibrate our intuition with this new disease and with these new tests. And I just the final thing to say is, you know, it can feel a bit scary, all this uncertainty at the moment, but we have to remember that having some uncertainty after testing is completely normal. You know, whenever you look at your pathology inbox, you don't come out of it and think, oh yes, I know exactly what's going on now. It's quite normal for there to be some residual uncertainty. The challenge for us is how we communicate that with our patients and interpret that for our individual patients.
Okay, yes, thank you. That's so, even if they test negative and they've got the symptoms, we should still think, actually, this is most likely COVID and treat it as such. So are there any factors that influence the reliability of the test?
Yes, that's really important to bear in mind. So, yeah, I think people can start to say, oh, the test is rubbish, but actually, it's quite a tricky disease. If there's virus on the swab, the test will pick it up. But the problem is that just because you've got virus in your body, it doesn't mean you'll pick it up on the swab. And a variety of factors will play into this. So if it depends on the timing of the test. So ideally, we need the tests to be done in the first 7 days after the symptoms have come on. If you do it too soon or too late, the sensitivity, the pickup rate will fall. And the best time of all, it seems to be about day 3 to 5. Another factor is the site of the sampling, where you take the swab from and how well you do the swab. So this has been shown in hospital studies where they've compared, you know, the sensitivity of bronchoalveolar lavage. So when you've got someone intubated, you pretty much always will pick up the virus if it's there. But when that's compared to the swabs in the throat and the nose, they have lower sensitivity. And I think when we talk to our patients who are doing self-swabs, often what we'll find is they'll say, well, I'm not quite sure if I really did manage to swab the back of my throat. I don't think I did it properly, or I was only able to do the front, the very sort of anterior part of my nostril. And so, you know, we would expect that that is likely to decrease the sensitivity a little bit as well.
Has there been any work about whether the test is more sensitive if it's done by a healthcare professional who's been trained to do the test on nasal swabs or then self-administered tests?
Well, I have seen one study. I haven't looked at it recently, but they were comparable, healthcare professional and self-swabs, but not identical. So there was a small drop in that sensitivity with the self-swabs. And I think that stands to reason. And I think that some of our patients will do self-swabs very, very well and have no problem with that. But some of the patients, you know, if you've got arthritis, if you're struggling physically to manage it, then it may be that actually the quality of the swabbing is less good.
Okay, so because of the number of false negatives, it's important just to keep a high level of suspicion about COVID-19 in patients with flu, especially those with atypical symptoms.
Especially as we're approaching winter, if you're in an area where there is a known high prevalence, we also have to bear that in mind as well, of course. Or if patients have got a high risk occupation. So we sort of need to balance all these contextual factors when we're interpreting these tests.
So, Jess, if the test isn't very accurate, should we still be encouraging people to test?
I think it's important to get across that, you know, testing's not going to be 100%, but we absolutely must encourage all our patients who are symptomatic to get tested, because it's the only way we're going to identify outbreaks and we're going to prevent them. So I just worry sometimes when people go, oh, you know, the tests are rubbish and there's false negatives. Yes, they don't pick up 100%. That's normal for tests, that they're not perfect, but that doesn't mean they're rubbish either. I fear that sort of the confusion in the media is meaning that patients are reluctant or forgetting or not thinking about getting tested. And it's really important for us to remember to encourage them, because they trust us.
And if you test a duck and you find out it's a duck, then that's really important, isn't it, really? We need to be finding ducks.
Yeah, because once we found the duck, then the test and trace can kick into action, and we can hopefully stop a localised outbreak in its track before it explodes. And one of the things that's different between COVID and flu, I think, is the number of people who seem asymptomatic, which as GPs perhaps less clinically relevant to us, but we have to kind of remember that as well, don't we? And I suppose it is relevant because we can have people who might have very mild symptoms who are almost symptomatic that might actually have it. And they might have such mild symptoms that they wouldn't bother to get tested unless we sort of really emphasise, yes, you must. I think we need to be remembering when we're doing our, you know, telephone triage that we need to be saying again and again to a patient, have you ordered a test? You know, have you ordered it? That needs to be at the forefront of our mind for so many of the kind of common presentations in primary care, flu-like symptoms, but lots of other common stuff too. You know, sore throat, gastrointestinal symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in a sense that we've slightly as GPs, we've got that public health hat on a little bit in that we may be thinking of that, but the individually might be thinking, well, I'm speaking to my GP because my concerns about my own health, but actually we're looking a little bit about the you know, the global impact or the identifying outbreaks more so perhaps more slightly more the public health side of it, which might not be on our patient's radar per se.
And of course, it's also important to remember that flu can kill as well. I think, 2017-18, over 22,000 patients died of flu, which the majority was over 65. So hence flu vaccine. Now, there's recently been a bit in the media about a 90-minute test to distinguish between COVID-19 and various strains of influenza. What's your opinion of this report, Jessica?
Well, I mean, clearly there would be significant potential benefits if we can have rapid tests turnaround and if we can have tests that would be able to pick up multiple viruses on the same sample. But as we are where we are now in August, I've not been able to see any peer-reviewed publications on either of these tests at the moment. So I think we're going to have to wait and see. And we'll have to wait and see whether these tests are provided to us in primary care, whether we have access to them, to know really how they'll fit into our current clinical pathways.
Great, thank you. So Tom, what are the red flags for patients with either flu or COVID?
You know, there are risks for COVID. They're not necessarily red flags, but there's risks which are the high risk groups. So people who are immunocompromised, people who are shielding, people of Black and Asian ethnic minorities. And then there are red flags, which is what we as GPs, you know, need to be focusing upon, looking at when we're assessing patients. And those are things like patients presenting with severe dyspnea, dyspnea on exercise, new onset confusion, chest pain, being desaturated less than 94% when we assess them, or actually looking unwell when we assess them. So those patients who are clammy and look sick, those are the patients who are running into trouble, and we really need to be thinking about getting them urgently assessed in secondary care. Or if we're speaking to them on the phone, asking them directly to be assessed in the secondary care environment, because we do know that these patients need to be getting into hospital quickly because they can be rapidly get very unwell. In clinical practice, I guess what we're going to be trying to do is tease out from patients, look, when did you start feeling unwell? If testing's not going to be available or reliable, then we're going to have to use something really to distinguish between them. Because of the longer incubation period with COVID, there's going to be, obviously that has an effect on the transmissibility, doesn't it? Because it's more highly transmissible, but it's got a longer incubation period. So people can be wandering around for a bit longer, passing it on, I guess. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I think all these things make it harder for us to kind of get on top of these outbreaks, which is why we've got to use the tools we've got as best we can.
The other thing is, sometimes I find with explaining to patients is having a positive test is really handy, but some patients might have a positive test because it's so sensitive and it's picking up bits of COVID. They might have it a long, fairly long way down the line, particularly those immunocompromised ones or on steroids. So they potentially they're not actually infective. True, you know, we can't actually tell that, but often, you know, if it's a few weeks down the line or something, more so I find in community hospitals, they're really not going to be that infective then. But it's such a good test if it is positive that it will just be picking up bits of viruses.
Yeah, I mean, you might just have a couple of virus particles. As I said, the fact that it's sensitive, if there's any virus on the swab, it's very sensitive. It's just the fact that not everyone who's got virus in their body will actually have it onto
exactly. them.
That's the problem.
So in conclusion, even though it's difficult to distinguish between COVID-19 and flu, some atypical symptoms like anosmia, skin rashes and ocular symptoms might help. Testing is also going to be paramount, but it's important to remember the high level of false negatives. And we shouldn't be too complacent about flu, because flu kills people each year. And it might be a good idea for people who've got flu to self-isolate as well. If you'd like some more facts and figures and references, do have a look on the infographic. So thank you very much, Tom and Jessica.